As Europe braces for energy shortages this winter, Russia appears to be burning supplies it would have sent to the continent. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. $10 million of natural gas per day seems to be burning off in Russia at a facility near the Finnish border. That's according to satellite images of a new Gazprom facility northwest of St. Petersburg. Europe is heavily reliant on Russia for its gas supplies, and it's been trying to reduce its dependence since the war in Ukraine began. Gas flows through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Germany have plunged to just around 20%. And most Western companies have left Russia. But French giant Total Energies still has a 49% stake in a gas field there, and the French government says now the company has questions to answer about reports it's been indirectly involved in supplying fuel to Russia's air force. The BBC's Hugh Schofield has more on those allegations from Paris.
The allegation is that a byproduct of this massive gas field is something called gas condensate, which can then be converted into aviation fuel. And the allegation is that part of this gas condensate production is being sent to Omsk, the city in central Russia, and being converted into aviation fuel. And then evidence is shown that this refinery in Omsk is supplying air force bases very near the Ukrainian border from where fighters and bombers are taking off to attack the Ukrainian army and population. It's a massive allegation which Total Energies immediately refutes. Yes, it operates this gas field, but what happens to the gas condensate? It is in the hands of its Russian partner out there. It has no control over what happens to this product of gas production.
And this is sort of where it gets a little bit sticky, right? Because Total owns almost half of that gas field, and it has an 18% stake in the Russian company that controls the rest of it. So the question then is, why has Total, given what other Western companies have done, not exited its position?
Well, it's not breaking any sanctions. The European sanctions that are coming in on petrol don't take effect till the end of the year. And after that, there are still many years before gas production is the object of European sanctions. So Total Energies can argue quite legitimately that it's not breaking any sanctions by being in Russia, and that in any case, Europe is importing Russian gas still, and Total Energies is helping provide that supply which Europe needs.
A former Green presidential candidate now is pressuring President Macron to demand that Total withdraw from Russia. Have we heard anything from his office about that? Do you think, how likely is that to be something that happens?
All we've heard from the government side is Clément Beaune, the transport minister, saying light should be shone on what is happening. I mean, clearly there's unease, there's embarrassment. Total Energies, quite above board, is still in Russia. I mean, this isn't some revelation. It's still in Russia. Everyone knows it's still in Russia. And it has invested massively in the run-up to this crisis period in Russian gas. This gas field in Siberia is a very, very important part of its portfolio. And because it's a very, very important French company, the French government feels awkward about this as well.
So more pressure building on Total then. The BBC's Hugh Schofield for us in Paris. Thanks for breaking this down.
Thank you.
Checking the numbers now, European stock benchmarks are little changed this morning after survey data showed consumer sentiment in Germany is forecast to hit a record low for the third straight month. As we've been discussing, households are bracing for a sharp rise in energy bills this side of the world thanks to a drop-off in Russian gas supplies. Here in the UK, the nation's energy regulator said this morning the average household will pay more than $4,000 for energy starting in October. That's an increase of 80% and three times higher than what consumers paid last winter. All eyes are trained today on the mountains of Jackson Hole, Wyoming, or more precisely, the meeting room where the world's central bankers are gathered for their annual get-together. Today, Fed Chief Jay Powell takes the stage, and anticipation is building that he'll double down on the Fed's commitment to crush inflation, which cooled slightly last month to 8.5%. We know rising prices are a problem all around the world, but the factors driving it are different region to region. Economist Dr. Mohamed El-Arian explains why, starting first with what's happening stateside.
The biggest pressure of prices are evolving. They were initially energy and food. That was round one of this inflation surge. Round two was a broadening to many more prices, including rent, including all sorts of goods and services. And we're now entering, I believe, round three, where wages are going to be main drivers of cost. And for the companies that still have pricing power, they will pass that on to consumers. So we will see headline inflation come down because energy and food are less important drivers, but core inflation is going to remain, unfortunately, persistently high.
And the other part of this, too, is that before it was a demand side problem, and that's something that central banks can sort of control. But now we're dealing with a lot of supply side problems, aren't we? So is that exacerbating the inflation problem in the U.S.?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, we are seeing a significant structural change, and inflation is just one illustration of what happens when that structural change. We used to be in a world of deficient aggregate demand. There wasn't enough demand in the system. And the Fed was concerned about inflation being too low. Now we are living in a world of deficient aggregate supply. The problems on the supply side, supply chains, labor markets, deglobalization, the list is long. And unfortunately, it has taken a long time for the Federal Reserve in particular to adjust to this paradigm change. In fact, if you look at this so-called new monetary framework, which was adopted only 2 years ago, it is still designed for a world of insufficient aggregate demand. And that's why they have been so late to address this inflation surge.
Can the Fed fix this problem?
It can, but at a high cost. And that is the problem right now. When you are as late as the Fed is, and remember, they mischaracterize inflation as transitory. Once they, quote, retired that word from their vocabulary in November, they didn't move fast enough. The communication has been inconsistent. Once you get yourself in a situation where you've made so many mistakes, you no longer have a first best policy response.
That mischaracterization of inflation, though, wasn't just the Fed's fault, really. We saw central bankers all around the world think that it was a temporary problem caused by pandemic pressures. You mentioned, so we've been talking about how core inflation is really the problem in the U.S., but if we look this side of the world, it's more food and energy prices, non-core inflation, that's really the driver here, isn't it?
It is. That's why already the inflation rate in the United Kingdom is at 10%. And the Bank of England believes it can get to 13%. Citibank believes it can get to 18%. What you have there is a major driver on the energy side, gas in particular. And that has to do with Europe's reliance on gas from Russia. So unlike the US, where the surge in oil prices is behind us now, that's not the case in Europe. We're still seeing gas prices going up. They've gone up again in the last couple of weeks, and that is adding to the inflation pressures.
Well, we've only just scratched the surface of the global inflation picture. We'll have much more with Dr. Elarian on Monday. He told me labor strikes here in the UK that we've been seeing over the last few weeks could be a warning for other countries. For now in London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.